Welcome to the Language Mastery Show. This is your host, John Fotheringham. In today's episode, I chat with David Sterling. He is a Thailand-based English teacher from the UK and the founder of the website go-interview.com, where he helps English learners build their language skills that they need to get their dream job. In the interview, we discuss how he fell in love with Thailand, why he got into English teaching, the different types of teaching jobs available in Thailand, how to break through the dreaded intermediate plateau, the pros and cons of group classes and online one-on-one tutoring, the importance of choosing a narrow niche in online teaching and in business, why David chose business English and interviewing as his niche, the power of having sufficiently high stakes in language learning, David's best tips for learning Thai, the importance of mastering sounds first in a language, and why you need to get corrected early and often. For show notes for this episode, go to languagemastery.com/show. All right, without further ado, here is my conversation with David Sterling. So I am excited to be joined today by David Sterling, who's coming all the way from the other side of the world in Thailand. So David, to start off with, what languages do you speak and how did you learn them?
Okay, thank you, John. First of all, I'd just like to thank you for having me here and say how much I appreciate it and that I've been a fan for a few years. And we'll come back to that. I think that's part of the story.
Thank you.
But to go to your question, the first language which I really had exposure to, foreign language, was French. And I was quite fortunate that my parents liked to speak French. My mom had been interested in French since she was a young student. So we got involved in a local kind of village exchange between a town in France called Albi and my local town. And this was an annual exchange which would alternate between having the French students and local children come over and stay with us and families in a place in England called Prestbury, which is a small village just south of Manchester. And then we would go over to Albi, which is a much more interesting town. We definitely got...
At least to you. Maybe they thought the opposite. Who knows? Yeah,
maybe they did. Maybe they did. But so even before I was old enough to go on these trips, because I have three older brothers, I would see French young people coming to stay with our house. And it was always very exciting. And I was quite impressed to hear my brother speak and communicate with these strange foreign people, you know, in a different language. So that was a sort of really early exposure. And then I think when I was old enough to do it, I'd started by that stage to learn French in school. But I think like most people, it was just, you know, here, open a book and here are some words and listen to this. And it was still academic and didn't mean very much. And, you know, if I was switched on, I might try and learn a few words, but I couldn't really put it into reality. I couldn't make that link until I went on the first exchange. And that was, yeah, a real eye-opener, to put it mildly. I remembered staying with a French family. I said we went to Albi, but my family stayed a little bit out of the city. So at times it was quite isolated. But yeah, I just remember waking up in this strange bed and being spoken to in French and thinking, where am I? What's going on?
I think suddenly seeing the gap between your, you know, school academic French, I'm sure, and real life spoken French, and just seeing how big that delta is, I'm sure, is also quite startling.
Exactly. Lève-toi, David. On prend le petit déjeuner. So, yeah, what is she saying? Okay, but, and I don't remember the exact words, as it's probably clear, but I do remember thinking, okay, I don't know that. What she's saying, this is impossible. How do I get by? But soon learning a few, like you say, putting things together and putting effort in so I could have my breakfast, so that I could eat what I wanted to eat. And then having that reward, that almost instant reward that you get when you're sort of immersed in the language. And I think also because I was on this exchange, I was with a group of my friends at the time. During the day, we'd have excursions and we'd go and visit places. So it was a lot of fun. But also there was this, yeah, massive exposure to the language and this necessity to speak the language, so I really enjoyed that experience. It was very challenging in the moment.
How long was the exchange, or how long were you in France?
I think it was around a week, maybe just over a week, 10 days. Not all that long, but at that age, long enough to make a big impression.
Sure.
And I also remember coming back then to the classroom, French classroom, and suddenly being going from like a sort of low average to right top of the class pretty much. And being able to use it, but not just that, being knowing about the usage of it. And it was a kind of a double whammy.
How much of that shift do you think was psychological, in that you now had been in an environment where you didn't understand what's going on, but the stakes were very high and real? And then back in the classroom, you're like, okay, this actually is real. This is not just memorizing things to pass a class. You know, these are actually the words and the phrases and the structures are used to communicate real things in a real world. And now I've seen that real world.
Yeah, massive. And I think I've never gone back from that stage. So, you know, you could say life-changing in that sense. But I don't know if I realized that at the time, but yeah, in retrospect.
So if somebody's listening to this and they've not had that experience, they've not lived abroad or done an exchange abroad, do you think there's any way that they can create that or manufacture that without going abroad? Or is that it? Is that the only real way you think to do it?
That's a really good question. And I think that you can do it. I mean, it might not be as complete as my experience. I'm not sure that's the best word, but I think you can.
Is life-changing,
the short answer.
Yeah.
Not quite as life-changing, but you can certainly recreate that. Even nowadays online with online lessons that you can find. I'm quite familiar with the platform iTalki because I've worked
that's
on
what
it a bit.
I recommend as well. Yeah.
But I think, you know, even nowadays, it's so easy to go on there and find a teacher and have that connection straight away that suddenly makes it real for me, whatever language I'm learning at the time. I find if I do that, suddenly that's in my head. So during the week, when I'm learning and listening, I want to, I don't know, maybe there's part of me, I still want to do my best, or I want to, you know, at least have the conversation, be able to connect with them and be able to to push what I can, how I can communicate with them.
And it creates, going back a bit to what we just talked about, it creates stakes. I think real stakes of, I don't want to show up for this 30 minute or 1 hour long, you know, session with somebody that I've paid for. So I don't want to waste my money either, but I also don't want to have completely awkward, you know, silences and not have anything to talk about. So I better darn well do some work this week before that session to have some vocabulary I can use, have some questions I can ask, have some structures I'm confused about that we can go through together, right?
Definitely. Yeah, that's the key.
So, okay, so that was French. So that's sort of the spider that bit you, as I like to talk about in the superhero analogy, right? So you got bit by the spider with this kind of French week-long homestay immersion situation. But now you live in Thailand and speak Thai to some degree, I assume. What originally got you interested in Thailand? Going from England to Thailand, that's a pretty big jump. So what originally got you interested, and how did you end up moving your entire life to Thailand?
Yes, a big jump. So I think probably, I mean, when I first went to Thailand, I was 27, 28. So after, I mean, I grew up in England, yes. After school, though, I did spend some time in Europe, in France. I was into skiing, so I was able to spend time in various ski resorts and continued learning
hard
French,
life.
Studied in France. Yeah, you know, I was loving it, but I guess I thought maybe there's not a complete career for me here. So, I mean, for various reasons, I went back to the UK. I was working as a travel agent for a while. That was kind of connected to the skiing, but not. And then that fell through, and I was doing sales for a gym, basically. But the reason that I went to Thailand, first of all, was friends of mine had done the kind of backpacking, you know, Southeast Asia, Australia. Groups of friends had been there a couple of times. And one time, one of my friends didn't come back and he stayed in Thailand. And I was like, well, where's James, my friend? And they were like, he stayed on. He met a girl. He stayed on in Thailand.
Yeah, okay, we don't need to notify the authorities. He stayed for, he's not in a jail or something.
No, it was voluntary. And I was very curious. And I thought, oh, well, he'll be back in a few months. Right? He didn't come back in a few months. And 6 months went by and a year went by. And then the friends were planning another trip to Thailand. And I was like, okay, well, I've got to go this time and got to find out what's James doing, my friend. So there was a real strong desire for me first just to go and check it out because I was really interested. and secondly, to see my friend. So I asked for time. I asked for time off from my job as a sales rep at this fitness club. But it was January. And as you probably know, January for that industry is the busiest time of year.
Right.
Everyone's doing their New Year's resolutions. So they basically said to me, no, you can't have any time off in January. So I said, okay, this is an okay job, but it's not a great job. Mm-hmm. I really want to go on this trip. So long and thanks for all the fish. Douglas Adams said.
Yes, indeed.
And basically I went there at a bit of a loose end, like at least with no commitment to come back. Even though I just booked for a month, I was able to extend my stay. And that's how I ended up staying.
So that first trip, so you just went to visit for the first time and you just stayed.
Yeah,
till basically. Now. I'm sure you've traveled.
Not quite, but I ended up staying over a year, that first one.
Because with visas, I assume you probably get like a 3-month landing visa as a Brit, and then
No. You get an exemption of 30 days, then you can get a tourist visa for another 60 days. But yeah, that's a difficult part. Yeah, I wasn't really prepared for that.
So then I assume you got a job teaching and that led to a year-long visa, is that right?
Yes, pretty much. So after 3 months, I extended from 1 to 3. Mm-hmm. After 3, I was running out of money. I couldn't extend my flight anymore. I had to make a decision. And my friend, actually, he was a teacher, an English teacher in Bangkok at the time. Mm-hmm. I think that, and I spoke to my parents and they said, okay, if you're going to stay, you could do teaching, you could do a TEFL. And I thought, okay, that sounds interesting. Let's do that. So I did that and I ended up staying. Before I came home, it was about probably close to 18 months. And I came back for about a 6-month period.
And so you did, you taught English then. Was it in person at like a English school or what was that like?
Actually, no. My first job after doing the TEFL certificate, which was about 6 weeks long, and that was a great experience.
But that was in Thailand? Or was that online?
That was in Thailand, yeah. I found a job at a language school, and it was actually phonics-based. It was owned by Australians. They'd launched this company in Singapore, and they had a franchise in Thailand. It was called I Can Read, and it was basically for younger children. I mean, they started as young as 4 and went up to about 12, 13 was the sort of average age. So I was working... Mm. I remember finding myself in this environment, working with very young Thai children, thinking, what am I doing? How did I get here?
Yeah. Probably not what you had in your mind when you were thinking of teaching English in Thailand.
Well, no, I guess, yeah. One thing led to another. There was no great grand design.
Mm-hmm. But different from what you do now, which I'm sure we'll touch on more later. But now I know you specifically focus on not only adults, but even, you know, a niche within a niche of adult business English and helping people with mastering the language of job interviews in English. But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. We'll come back to that. Okay. So you figured out basically in the end, not only how to stay in Thailand, but I guess a why in a sense of a new career, which from the sound of it, I mean, teaching in general, but probably teaching English was not something that you earlier in your life thought you would maybe do with your life. That seemed to have evolved kind of organically.
Yeah, that's right. I think at the time, the only comparison I could make is I said I was doing skiing and I was trained as an instructor with the Basie quality. So I was teaching people skiing on the mountain. Obviously it's very different, but mm-hmm.
There's a through line with teaching. I think any topic there, I think there are principles probably that do apply. So, okay. So you did have that experience of helping people with a complex skill. Cause in many ways, like you could probably say that skiing and speaking a language are actually more alike than you might think. I think languages are more like skiing than they are like other academic subjects.
It's interesting. I never thought of it that way, but I definitely could see some parallel.
I mean, it's complicated. It's physical. You can't explicitly teach it because it's not really about facts. It's about procedural memory. I mean, trying to teach somebody to keep your skis parallel and to, you know, put your hips into it and these kind of things. You can't read that in a book, right? You have to go out on the ski hill and do it. And I think languages are much the same. Anyway, maybe that's a tangent for another day.
That's cool.
So you did this TEFL program in Thailand. Maybe we should probably define for people, what is TEFL?
Yeah, TEFL basically stands for Teaching English as a Foreign Language. And it's a certificate that you get so that you can teach English to non-native English speakers. And there are various levels. I know some of them you can do online, and I'm not an expert per se, but the one that I did, it was 6 weeks, and that was considered to be a kind of compressed course. It was quite intensive. We'd go in every day from morning till afternoon, and we get instructed on, first of all, the theory, and we'd practice within the group. And then the latter part of the course, we would basically practice what we'd learned on local guinea pigs. I mean, local Thai students who were willing volunteers.
Mm-hmm. So it was a practical application. It wasn't just classroom learning.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a similar. I did TESOL, which is teaching English to speakers of other languages, just even more alphabet soup. And that just happened to be, that was offered at my university because I was studying linguistics and then started to kind of think about, okay, what can you do with linguistics other than just teach linguistics? And so I started looking at teaching English as an avenue for that. Do you think, having now done that and now having been teaching English professionally for a while, and I'm sure you know lots of other English teachers as well in Thailand and around the world, is doing something like TEFL necessary to start? Or is it something that maybe it's not necessary, but is worth the time and money? Or do you think it's just kind of a nice to have? Where would you kind of place it now?
I think it's worthwhile. For me, in my experience, it definitely helped me. Not only was it was necessary to get a job in my case, and it may not be everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, I also think it was worthwhile. It helped with my, you know, my confidence. I was in a completely new environment, a new country, and in new the classroom,
right?
New profession. Yeah. Rather than being on the mountain where, you know, I can be king of the hill, it was
literally
at least with my beginner student. So big difference. It helped me with the confidence. I learned a lot. I met also for me at the time, I met other people who were in the same boat, who were, you know, coming to Thailand and learning to teach. So I made some friends, which I've still kept in contact to this day. Yeah, definitely a worthwhile experience.
Yeah, I definitely would say the same. I think we should caution people listening that I think there's a wide range of these kind of programs available. I think all the way from top-notch, high quality to kind of shady cash grab territory.
So I've heard about those.
Yeah, you just buyer beware, do your research. But yeah, I definitely would agree. The English teaching jobs that I had in Japan and Taiwan certainly didn't require that kind of certification, but I'm certainly glad I had it. I think it definitely helped me to do the job well and to enjoy doing it, which I think is a really underappreciated component of kind of life quality is, you know, the better you are at doing a thing, usually the more enjoyable it becomes. Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit here. You've got this certification in hand. Take us from that to now what you're doing today.
Okay. So initially when I came to Bangkok, after I traveled around and done my backpacking thing and I started to work, I was based in Bangkok. I'm sure most listeners know, but Bangkok, the capital of Thailand, and Thailand here, it's
huge, you know,
it's
city.
A big metropolis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Compared to anywhere else in Thailand, it dwarfs them. So that's where the majority of the jobs are, the work, the people and other life. I mean, for anyone thinking of coming and living, it can be quite imposing, you know, and it's a big city, but basically that's where I was. And so it was easy for me to find different jobs. So I worked this job for a while and it was enjoyable. And I enjoyed working with little children. And at the time when I first came to Thailand, I kind of started learning Thai from day one, and maybe we'll come to this in the next one, but even going to the school and learning and being in small classrooms with children, because this was a private school. So we were in a nice air-conditioned classroom. I could walk to work. The maximum class size was 8.
Wow.
Maybe they pushed it to 9 or 10. So it was really small and focused. And I could spend time with the children, teaching them and even learning a few Thai words with them, which, you know, for a beginner in the language, learning with kids is a great experience. But that lasted for just over a year, maybe a year and a half. And then, for whatever reason, I left that job and I went and I got a job in a more traditional school, a high school here, a government high school. And that again is, even though I'd been in Thailand for a while and I taught as a professional teacher, it was a new experience completely. Suddenly you're in big classrooms with not necessarily air conditioning. Some rooms had air conditioning, some didn't. But it was a different experience being in front of, this time, big class sizes. Government, probably at least in the smaller class sizes, were like late 20s. In the bigger ones, you'd have 40 plus. You know, you can imagine that you can't teach to everybody in that classroom. You have.
Yeah. And I imagine what is being taught. I don't know about the Thai English education system specifically, but just what I know from many other English curricula, it's not exactly communicative English that's being taught is my guess, right? It's a lot of like talking about the grammar and the vocabulary of English, but not necessarily communicating in English. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, as the foreign teachers in the English department, we were, you know, given that job, if you like, of the
that's what you're brought in to do is like, okay, you're going to now be the native speaker who can help them communicate.
Yeah. And the other Thai teachers would maybe teach them the basics of the grammar. Yes, there'd be grammatical elements, but that's what we were trying to do. But in a large class that size, obviously there's different times. There's a production time and there's the practice time and the presentation, the three P's of learning. But that was a theory. But in practice, you try and do that, try and, you know, give them a presentation, get people up in front of the class, have them produce it, and then have them practice in their own time. But it was pretty basic, what we were doing. They didn't have much chance to dive too deep.
It's also tough at that age, I think, for any nationality to try to learn a foreign language, perform in that language whilst going through puberty and dealing with all the, you know, the challenges that go with that, figuring out your identity and your native culture and language, let alone having to then do that in another. I mean, I just think there's some particular challenges for that age group.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, with each group, maybe we got an hour a week. Good luck.
So then after that, you left, and then were there other jobs in between, or is that when you decided to then start focusing on adults? What was the journey there?
No. So I worked in that school, and I worked in another school, which was a girls' school, and it wasn't quite private, but it was something in the middle. It was like a special sponsored, he called it a queen's school. Hmm. And here they brought me in, and this was the language, because it was an agency that brought me into the school, and they needed someone not only to teach English, but to teach maths and science.
Oh, wow.
I blatantly wasn't qualified to do maths to the year one. I could just about, you know, I could handle that, and biology even to year one. But when it came to chemistry to like 15-year-olds at that level, I was blatantly out of my depth. Science teacher knew it straight away, and the students didn't take long to work it out. But that's what they wanted. They wanted their science in English.
Yeah, wow.
So I did my best to stay, you know, a few pages ahead of them in the textbook. And so I was. So this is kind of the system there, that this kind of thing happens. But I did my best, and I think I did okay.
In theory, I like the idea of it, of you're learning in context. But to find a native speaker of English who also has the content knowledge and expertise, that's a pretty thin sliver of a Venn diagram. I mean, good luck. Who's also in Thailand.
It's how much they want to pay them as well. Yeah.
I imagine a fortune. I imagine so. Yeah. So, okay. So that was not the blissful end all be all you were searching for career wise.
No, it wasn't. But it was a lot of fun, and it was interesting, and I kind of look back fondly. And then I went to working for agencies, but working more, doing jobs, going into offices, going into some government agencies. And at the same time, I'd found someone who could get me work. She was an agent. She could get me private work doing similar thing. And that was a mix of children and adults. Mm-hmm. And I even started advertising my own locally and getting some interest that way. So I was starting to branch out and doing different things, finding enjoyment in the variety.
When you say agency, this is like a kind of a matchmaker who they have contracts with various companies and government agencies and schools and everything, and then they place you these different places. Okay. I did something similar in Taiwan. You know, pros and cons, I imagine. They are going to have more contacts than you as an individual probably do, but then they're also taking a cut, right, of the compensation, I imagine.
Sure. But then they get access to better deals. Yeah, usually it worked out.
Would you have done that again if you were to start from scratch? Would you do the same kind of trajectory, you think? Or would you just try to skip ahead to kind of just being your own?
Yeah, I think it was useful. If I would do it again, I would probably be more conscious of recording the stuff that I'm doing. I mean, it's easy to say now and you know,
systematizing.
Systematizing it, making my own content and stuff, which I'm quite aware of now, the necessity to do that. But yeah, it was a good learning process for me. I wouldn't change that, I don't think.
Are there any other mistakes that you think you made in your professional journey, that things that people are starting out could avoid the same pitfalls?
Double check everything that you're told. Don't assume anything about the job. Make sure, and preferably make sure you've got things in writing. Mm-hmm. And you might not get that, but at least to try and to show that you're on the ball from the outset. But then having said that, you do need to be a bit flexible and a bit kind of accepting in return that, you know, things aren't going to be exactly as you want them. So Does that make sense? If you can be.
Yeah. Because I don't want to infer too much because I didn't have your journey, but I'm imagining that there's probably sometimes where things were promised or said that weren't delivered. And maybe there was some malfeasance involved or just maybe over promising and under delivering. And probably other times it's just things couldn't be anticipated or expected and you have to be flexible and, you know, things change and happen. There's probably a bit of both. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say that overpromising and also just the cultural differences, which you're, you know, sure. You might be expected to do things. And I've, you know, my experience wasn't too extreme, but I've heard other many stories and you know, walking around or just meeting other teachers, some of them were quite embittered by their experience. Mm. But you wonder how, I think the people who get like that are probably very rigid and they have expectations from their country of origin. And I think if you really are too rigid, then you're going to have a hard time of it.
Sure. Can you share any examples that come to mind of these kind of clash of cultures that you've either experienced or know of amongst friends or colleagues?
Yeah. So it could be, for example, if your school has a special day, let's say it's Y Crew Day, which is the teacher's day, if you like, the translation. You may be expected then to dress up even in some occasions and to get involved in these activities.
Mm-hmm.
Other times you just might have to do a class playground duty, you know, at the school or gate duty. The school may want to project and to show passers-by that they have Western teachers.
Oh, I see.
So this kind of thing's quite common.
And there's a resistance from that of the English teacher because they thought either this is not in my contract or they feel a bit objectified, right? Or kind of like a, you know, dance monkey dance sort of thing.
Yes, definitely. And even in my own case, I must admit the first school, which I told you about, they wanted me to go on a training day, which was on my usual day off, and it wasn't any extra paid. And I objected to that and refused. And you asked me about regret. I think I should have just gone along with that and I could have met people and learned things, but I was a bit like, no, I'm not getting paid for this.
Yeah.
Why should I go?
It's tough. Yeah. Where do you draw those lines? And I don't think there's a right answer there, because if you agree to everything and you don't have boundaries, then people will tend to just take as much as they can get. And this is not unique to any culture. I think that's just human nature. Employers want to get as much value as they can from their employees. And employees, of course, want to get paid as much as they can for the work they do. And there's nothing wrong with either of those, but they're in conflict. There's a tension there. So you kind of, I think, have to figure out where your line is and how much you're willing to do. But you also don't want to be the person that doesn't ever go above and beyond. I mean, you want to be well-liked and respected, and you want to be someone seen as a team player and a go-getter, a giver. I don't know. It's a tricky tension, isn't it? So I want to talk a little bit now about your Thai experience, learning Thai and living in Thailand. So you started learning Thai when you said from day one, once you got there, you started trying to learn the language.
Yeah. So even on the plane, I remember learning the basic reads. It's like, okay, sa wat di. And okay, I can say this to the taxi driver. And he replied me, oh, so what did happen? What did he say? He said something extra. And I didn't, and I'd left my book in the back. So I was like, okay, I don't have a clue what he's doing here. But when I got to the hotel, I was like, okay, learn some more words and meet some people, use this. And yeah, so that was very kind of basic.
But not everyone does that. So I think that's important that right out of the gate, you had the attitude of, I'm at least going to try. So what was your language learning like from then? Did you take classes? Did you do self-study? Did you work with tutors? What did you do?
I didn't take any classes. Mostly it was self-study. It was with people. And there were various stages to my development. At the beginning, when I was with my friends and I was on holiday and I was just, we met some local people. So I was learning a little bit then, but it was, completely different language with the tones. I didn't have a clue what was going on. Yeah, it can be fun if you're with local people and you're exchanging a bit of language and they can be quite impressed that you know anything at all. And
again, because the bar is so low. Because most expats, don't learn any. So, and our Thai people, I've visited a few times, but I don't know the culture nearly as well as you do. But the sense I got was any effort you make to speak the local language is met with either surprise or praise and a lot of warmth. I mean, the bar to get over of getting positive feedback, I think, is very, very little compared to, I mean, if you flip the script, right? Somebody that goes to the UK, the US, somebody's English level has to be very, very, very high, I think, for them to get the same level of praise or positive feedback. It's definitely not a fair shake, in my opinion.
You're right. And I remember listening to a previous podcast of yours. You were speaking with a guest whose name I can't remember now, but talking about this in Japan, and you'll get praise used a lot in the early stages. Mm-hmm. And then it's only when you get to a certain level of fluency, suddenly people start to say, put my chat, you can't be clearly, you know.
Yes, definitely with Japanese, it's the running joke is you'll always hear how good your Japanese is when it's not. But then as you go further along, you know you've arrived basically at a decent level of fluency when you stop getting praised. You stop getting
any comments. That kind of thing. And in that period where it's probably most important that you're getting this, there's lots of praise. People appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I can remember talking about the stages. I remember when I'd got a basis of Thai, a very rough base. But then I was maybe in a taxi journey, because in Thailand, especially in Bangkok, lots of taxis are very mm-hmm. cheap. So you can spend quite a bit of time moving around the traffic of, mm-hmm. of Thailand. So that's a great chance to speak. But suddenly, you know, sure. it's very basic. It can be a bit painful at the beginning. Trying to talk about the weather, for example, which mm-hmm. as a Brit, this is, of course, a natural topic. But, you know, Thais don't talk about the weather as much, maybe a few
words.
It
doesn't change as much, maybe. That's why. Yeah.
It's reckon that. But still, people appreciate that. And mm-hmm. those early efforts, I think, are important. And just kind of getting over the fact that you can't say very much, but just trying to say what you can say and look, you know, paying attention to what you get back. And that effort, I think that's a really important stage for a lot of people who they may say, oh, I can't do this and give up. Or if you can push through that, then, you know, you can get to the Elysian fields below beyond. Not quite, but you know what I mean?
I tend to think of it as there's the initial little beginner's buzz. And then you get the first little kind of trough of despair where you realize mm-hmm. how hard it is. And then you keep going. And then you get to the intermediate plateau. And then that one, that's another challenge. Because by that point, you're still learning the same absolute rate, but the relative rate feels like almost zero. Mm-hmm. You know, because when you start out, you learn 5 words a day. That's 0 to 5 is a huge jump. But then 5 to 10 mm-hmm. is less so. And then 10 to 15, you get my point. So how do you keep yourself going? I mean, even like now in Thai, I assume you're still learning and still progressing. But at this time, I imagine the perceived progress is probably a lot slower. So have you figured out any psychological strategies or any kind of habit formation tricks or routines or things that you do to keep yourself going at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I must be completely open and honest and say that I sort of feel and have felt for couple of years that my Thai is not getting any better. It may even be, you know, going the other way. So I'm kind of aware of, conscious of that. And as someone who works in the field and who pushes people, even when they reach a high level, to improve their level, I sometimes feel a bit like the mechanic who doesn't take care of his car that well, you know. And it's kind of terrible to say this, but it's also, I'm still, I thought about this before, just I came on and with the language, you know, I speak Thai every day with my wife, with people around me, with her family. But sometimes I think what I would need now, I'm feeling that I want to go back and have formal lessons or do my work, perhaps do some videos in Thai. This is mm-hmm. something I've thought about, and I've done some, but produce stuff more on social media, because for me, that's putting myself again out of my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. I think, and there's that, what we said at the beginning, you put that back to that sort of motivation, that fear factor and that, you know, that desire to do well, to improve, to do my best. So
I have those stakes again, you know, if I'm going to be on video in Thai, I want to make sure that throughout the week, I'm doing everything I can to make sure that what comes out of my mouth with a video camera on me is going to be the best I can do. Right. I think that's brilliant. You're definitely not alone. I mean, this tension between having high expectations and knowing what's possible, having done that for other people learning English, and then looking at your own performance in a foreign language and seeing that gap, it's probably universal. Honestly, everyone I know who both learns and teaches languages, they all have that. So I don't think that that's a unique, you know, this turned into a therapy session somehow, but I don't think that's a unique failing or anything that you have. I certainly feel that way myself, and most people I know have the same. So anyone listening too, don't beat yourself up too much. Be aware this is common, but then also, you know, take action. Being aware this is an issue and that there is that gap, but knowing that there are ways forward. It's not inevitable that you get stuck on the intermediate plateau forever. There are ways ahead. I think, you know, deliberate practice, I think, is probably the first thing that comes to mind. And for anyone not familiar, deliberate practice isn't just practice on purpose. That's part of it, but it's, you really dig in and you focus on your errors and your mistakes and the holes in your vocabulary and the sort of fossilized mistakes you make over and over and over and over again. And to do this, you really do need a tutor. You need a teacher. You need somebody who can shine the light on those errors and mistakes and then hyper focus on them. And it's uncomfortable and it's painful. And that's why most people don't do it. Cause you get to that level where you're like you said, I could talk to my wife. I could talk to family and friends. I can get by. And so you're kind of disincentivized to keep improving because you've got to a comfortable level and it's really hard.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've come quite far with my, cause I've been here for that many years, coming back a little bit, rewinding the clock. There was a point that I decided I wanted to learn the script as well, mm-hmm. the writing system and time. And I did that. And I remember one guy who was a great friend of mine, unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but an American guy, he'd been here even longer and he spoke Thai like no foreigner I'd seen here before. He'd really mastered the sound of the language. He had a great ear for the language and he could really replicate the sound very well. And I spent a lot of time hanging out with him and he was one of the sort of pushes.
And he normalized performing it at that, such a high level. I think that's also important to know people, to know other expats or foreigners who have reached a really high level, because then you know it's possible.
Yes. But then I also, because, you know, with Thai, there's they have their own system of writing, which is very accurate, you know, much more than English, of reproducing the sound. It's a bit complicated when you're learning it, but once you've got it, most words read as they sound.
Is it one-to-one then, or almost, between symbol and sound?
Yes, yeah. And it can be complicated because the vowels can come before the consonant. So you've got this kind of, you know, grouping of letters with each thing, and that can take some time to get your head around. But
so is it syllabic? Is each like symbol basically covering a syllable with a vowel and a consonant? I wish I knew more about Thai. No, I don't.
Yeah. No, not quite. No, they've got the consonant groups. There's 44 of those. And a lot of them they don't really use very regularly.
I see.
But I'd say about 30 of them they probably use more or less regularly. And then the vowels which will go around them. But they also have classes of the consonant, so that will determine the tone. But then depends on the vowel sound and the syllable ending. So, you know, there are some complicated things going on.
But it's doable.
Yeah.
Kids do it every day, right? That's always, we have to remind ourselves, like, as complicated as these things seem, it's so easy a baby can do it, right?
And that was another great thing. I remember when I was beginning my writing journey and I'd been with the kids, if I could write something on the board in Thai, even in the big groups, then suddenly they'd go, wow, you know, I'd get this wave of appreciation from 12-year-olds. But, you know.
Which helps, you know?
Yeah. I think it shows them that you're willing and able to make mistakes and put yourself out there.
Right. So
that had a double benefit.
And I think there is something about writing the language, especially with younger learners who they themselves either are still learning or just learned how to write their language. There's something about that. There's an empathy that comes with that they remember how hard it was. Whereas with adult learners, it's so long ago that they learned to write their native language. They've forgotten how hard it was, even for them. At least that's been my experience. Yeah. So let's go back now to the teaching side of things. So you run a website, go-interview.com. You specifically focus on helping people master the language of interviews, of doing interviews in English so they can actually get the job they want. So how did you decide on that as your niche?
I think I came to that. So first of all, I should probably wind back a little bit and say that at the time I moved away from Bangkok, which was about 2018, and I moved to a small town in Bangkok called Hua Hin, which is a tourist resort. It's a lovely place. We used to go on holiday. We wanted to get out of the city, my wife and I. So we moved down there and we went a bit out on a limb. You know, didn't have a job at first, was trying various things. It's not so easy to get a job in a school. There's not so many schools there. Mm-hmm. I tried, that wasn't working. So then I looked online for work. And first of all, I got to work for Chinese companies because they were quite big of online education. It was relatively easy to get a job with them. And again, teaching young kids, but online, usually in groups at least, and they had their systems. Mm-hmm. And that was quite interesting, quite fun, quite, you know, energy intensive.
So these are Chinese students learning English?
Yes, usually young ones.
Got it. Okay.
Similar age to the phonics work that I'd done before in the classroom. And that worked okay. And that, you know, they had their special hours, set hours, it paid relatively well as well for online work. But also it wasn't quite enough because it was only a short window in the day. And then I found another company based in Taiwan, which had more opportunity to teach online, but to teach not just children, but adults as well. So that was my first, I think, experience of teaching adults online. Again, they gave you the timetable, the program. You had to fit into their schedule, but it was a good experience in that there was teaching adults online. Then I think the next step was I went to Cambly because I wanted more autonomy. I wanted to try out new platforms and do my own thing, but with a bit more independence. Mm-hmm. Found Cambly, and that was interesting for me. That was another step into the unknown, if you like, because suddenly I was there and I had no syllabus. No one was telling me you need to teach this today. Mm-hmm. You're just, here's someone who wants to learn English and spend the time with them and make them talk, kind of
thing. Right, which is a mixed bag. I mean, you get the freedom, which is can be wonderful, but freedom can also be paralyzing in some ways, right? Because there's no constraints. Like, you have to create the constraints yourself. So through that process, then, did you start building your own syllabi and curricula, or did that kind of evolve organically?
That evolved organically, but I did start doing that. But as I was going along, I realized the need for it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. You know, I can show up and talk for an hour. That you have one conversation, you've kind of used up your introduction and your my hobbies are, here's my, you're right. You have to start creating some structure, which is kind of ironic, because I think a lot of people get burnt out by the mainstream traditional academic way of doing languages. They come to online learning and go, ooh, finally, I can have more freedom. This will be more of, we'll just talk. It'll just be fun. And that is an improvement in many ways, but you do kind of lose the baby with the bathwater, I think, in some ways. So yeah, tell us more about what you figured out doing these lessons effectively.
Yeah, I think the first thing that I figured out was the fact that I could do it. The second thing was that I needed some resources. I need a lot of resources and backup. Maybe the third thing was that everybody was different. At least not everyone's the same. There's different people looking for different things.
Because these are one-on-one lessons that you were doing mostly.
Yeah.
So you have the option to personalize it, which is also a huge difference between these high school classes, right? Or even these 8-person children groups you're doing with the phonics thing. Now it's one-on-one. Yeah. So you have the opportunity to personalize, but then there's also the expectation to personalize, right?
Yeah. And I remember seeing videos online of people doing it, and one guy saying, okay, what are we going to talk about today? And it just seemed so open and stepping into the void.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, can you really do that? And with some people you can, and with experience, you become more comfortable doing that. You know which way you can take it. But yeah, at the beginning, I used various resources that I came onto that I thought were better. There's one that I came across, which is called Off to Class. I'm not sure if you've heard of that one. It's basically it's an online kind of syllabuses for teachers. So you pay, the teacher pays the membership subscription, and you can have a certain number of students on there who they log onto the system.
So it's just like an online kind of syllabus, or is it a LMS, or what is this exactly?
An LMS.
Learning management system. Like, is this like a portal where you're meeting them online via this thing? I'm just not quite clear what it is.
I believe you can do that, but no, I didn't. That wasn't how I used it. I'd usually meet them on Zoom or on another platform.
Gotcha.
But it is actually interactive. So if they are one of your subscribed students, they can then log in and they'll see the screen. And there's some elements that, so there's some, as well as having the prompts and the stories and pictures, there's also an audio part to it. So that gives you some kind of structure for the students that want more structure. And as a teacher, maybe who has come from this complete structure that you have to do this, not having anything at all, this is quite a good tool which can kind of help you cover that middle ground.
Are you still using something like that now, or are you using only completely stuff you've created yourself?
I do still use that occasionally. I have it with a couple of students that are on there, and you can still go on there and browse and use the material. Because it has a lot of good elements, which I think are still useful. And I often put this to my students at the beginning. I can say, we can do this, or we can go more freestyle. And I have a lot of prompts and topics and ways that I go down. And usually I say to most students, if they're at a certain level, then the best use of time that we can have together as a one-to-one lesson is more on the conversation style. Right. Yes, sometimes use that for the prompts and topics, but don't get too heavily involved in that, because that's a bit like, you know, going back to the classroom, and it's not always the most effective way to learn.
So for your higher level students, where you're trying to keep it more conversationally focused, do you still agree on a topic or a theme or anything ahead of time? Or is it more just kind of freestyle what comes up?
It varies. Some people will ask for a plan, and I'm happy to give that, say, a 10 lesson plan. And again, we can stick to that or diverge from that depending on how it goes. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a good idea. And what I also like to do is to give some material in between sessions for them to go away and spend time with.
Like articles.
Especially or podcasts.
Yeah, podcasts are great. Yeah, I found when I was teaching in Taiwan, like you earlier said, I worked with an agency that placed me at different companies and businesses. A lot of times I was working one-on-one with like an executive or a CEO of a company. And you know, these were very high-level English learners, very interested in their particular field. And so what ended up usually being the best bet, this was 2008, I think, think it was about then. So podcasting was very new still. And so Harvard Business Review was great because they had, they were one of the pioneers in this, is they would have their articles and they would have the audio of each of their articles. And so we would basically before the class, I would pick or they would pick a Harvard Business Review article on some kind of topic they're interested in related to their field, like risk management or something like that. And then they would read the article, listen to the podcast. And then I would pick out words, idioms, phrases that I knew they probably didn't know or would struggle with that wouldn't be quite as intuitive maybe as others might be. And then we just talked about those things. It was great because that created enough structure that we had something to push off of, but it was free enough that it ended up just basically being a conversation about those topics or things.
Yeah.
And it didn't take a lot of preparation too, which as for the teacher side is nice. You know, I could just read the article. I didn't have to go and plan out a whole lesson from scratch. So that worked really well.
Yeah, that's a win-win. That kind of thing works really well.
But it takes a long time to get there. And it also, to your point, it has to be more advanced learners. For somebody that's just the very beginning of English or even just kind of lower intermediate, you can do it. If it's a shorter article or you only focus on a few sentences, you can still do that. But it definitely would not probably work as well with the lower levels.
No, and that's where this after class and similar things, I guess, can come in quite handy. And when I was working with children as well, it's good to have that. And that also provides homework assignments for them. So and that can, you can look at that on the platform. So it is very good on that side things.
And that's only for English or is that for multiple languages?
Only for English, as far as I know.
Yeah, sounds cool. I'll definitely check it out. So, okay, we started talking about it a little bit. So gointerview.com. So you focus on job interviews. Why specifically that niche? I mean, there's a lot of things you could talk about. And I think niching in general is a very interesting topic for business because I know a lot of people, myself included, like, I love languages. I want to talk about all languages and I want to talk about all aspects of language learning. I don't want to have to limit myself down to this tiny little circle. But as is often said, if everyone's your customer, no one's your customer. So it's essential definitely that you pick a small enough audience that you can really focus on and that they can then find you, right? Because everything you talk about is like, this is what I do. I don't do that. I don't do that. I do this. So why job interviews? How did you figure that out?
Yeah, I think you've kind of, helped me or at least led into the answer, which is the real answer, which is the reason I niched down is because I knew that I, as a business, because I wanted to take, I'd gone as an independent teacher, but I wanted to sort of take it to the next step to move to have my own business around English teaching. So I knew, and I joined actually, there's a guy who runs a course who was teaching online, teaching business online. Yes, I think it was once I joined that course that I then decided, I had it in my mind, I enjoyed working with adults. I knew there was a need in the market. Lots of people came to me and said, I've got a job interview coming up. Mm-hmm. And it also at that period, even at a small time, it's an important time for them. So that's the time that somebody's likely to come and say, okay, I need some help with this. I'm willing to pay money. There's a tangible result, a financial result.
Again, going back to that.
Yeah.
The theme of the conversation.
It's funny that, because I once, when I launched my own company in the UK, had a limited company, I named it, my name, Sterling Steaks was the name of it.
Oh, so there we go. I like that.
Synchronicity.
Yeah.
Coming in.
And alliteration. I'm a total sucker for alliteration. So I love
that. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Wow, I love that too. But anyway, that kind of isn't going at the moment, but it may do again. But back to your point about why I chose that niche. Yeah, there was a need for it. It was something that I enjoyed. All those factors on the business side of things. And yes, to your point about, do I just want to talk to people who have got interviews coming up? No, there's more than that.
Right, right.
And what I've come to realize and I'm putting in or trying to put into my marketing as well is that, go interview is about the interview, but really it's like Buzz Lightyear. It's go interview and beyond. For the next stage, because a lot of people think once they've passed the interview and that's it, relax. Whereas, of course, that can often just be the beginning. Suddenly, oh my God, I've got to speak English to clients and colleagues from all over the world, different accents, native speakers, non-native speakers. Help, and so a lot of people come to me at that stage as well. So, the go interview perhaps is to have a niche in the market. People come and find me. But the other part is equally, if not more important, to help people excel in the work they do.
Yeah.
you know, to do and to enjoy it, to come back to your point as well. Enjoy their work.
Yeah, and enjoy the language too. Languages are a portal into other worlds. And so as a business, I think often people start with a job or a business, and then that leads to new interests and new friendships and new travels that they never would have had otherwise. So it's probably very American of me, but I do think entrepreneurship and business can lead to fulfillment in a way that just hobbies or personal interests won't. I don't know. I'm a bit wary of saying that because entrepreneurship is also, it's kind of become a religion almost amongst, you know, like the whole Silicon Valley and all that stuff. So I don't want to go too far down that utopian worldview. We've seen how that can go wrong also, but I still think there's some truth to that. So kind of to wrap up, David, what would you say to somebody? Let's do a two-parter here. So one about kind of the business side of and teaching side, and the one about just the learning languages side. So on the business side, if somebody wants to move abroad and teach English, not necessarily only in Thailand, but just wherever it is that they're curious about, what would you say is the absolute first step they should take? Is it doing like a TEFL program? Is it talking to somebody who has already done it? Like, what do you think is the absolute first step?
Yeah, it's difficult for me to give a definitive answer on that. But I think I would say definitely do as much research as you can. Because in my case, I sort of went out there and made it up as I went along. And I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to everyone. But on the other hand, if you want to have all your ducks in a row, then you could be waiting forever and miss doing anything. So I guess I would say try and find a sweet spot in between there. Do research online, maybe visit the country, but it's not necessary that you do. Try and find maybe a working holiday. Nowadays, there are quite a lot of these for younger people. If you've got some time off university and there's an opportunity to do like a month teaching in Thailand, for example, then yeah, I would say those are really great for testing the water. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see if it's something you're gonna love, or you're gonna just never want to come back and do again. If not, you're not stuck out here. You've got something to go back.
Yeah, and it kind of goes full circle to your experience in France. I think having that 1 week there, even though it was only 1 week, it was 24/7 visceral, psychological, affective immersion that changed your life. And I think maybe adults, maybe 1 week is not enough. Maybe you need a month or two. But yeah, I agree. Doing a test run in a foreign country that you're thinking about, I mean, what do you got to lose, right?
Right. Yeah, I definitely think that. And I know there are lots of companies that do that. I almost worked for one as a management. That was another job that I kind of applied for when I first moved to the Hua Hin. Didn't get that, but maybe that was my
fate. For the best. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, what's the quote? Be careful what you wish for. You just might get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes we're lucky when the things don't go the way we thought they might or wanted to at the time. Okay. So then on the language learning side, so for Thai specific learners, people that want to actually learn Thai, now that you know what you know about the language, about the culture, what do you wish you would have known when you first started learning Thai that you know now? And this could be both in how to learn or just specifically about the language and the culture.
I think it's about the importance of the tones and learn these, even though they're very strange. And it's probably best spending some time, real quality time with them at the beginning, getting your ear used to them. That's what they do. That's how they train them in the school for the local children, so they can just pick them up. They know. I still have to think about it. There's five tones in Thai.
Okay.
So you've got the middle tone, high tone, low tone, rising and falling. But those descriptions in themselves aren't fully, you know.
Sure.
You know,
I don't know Thai, but by analogy, I know from Mandarin that, yeah, these kind of simplistic descriptions are just that. They're simplistic. And I imagine things change in context. So, okay. So nail the tones, nail pronunciation first.
Yeah. Doing that, listening to audio. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before you get too many bad habits.
Right. Are there specific resources or materials that you would recommend or that you found helpful with pronunciation specifically?
Yeah, there's one, which is the thailanguage.com website. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a Thai dictionary, but they've got audio clips of all the stuff plus longer. I found that very useful at different parts. What else? There's a resource which I kind of once had, but I don't think I kind of lost it. It's one of those that disappeared. And so I don't know if people can find it or you could find it. But I think it was put out by the American government, funnily enough, to teach people. And I'll maybe have to try and come back. And
is it Foreign Service Institute one, FSI?
Yes, that rings a bell. Yeah.
Yeah, those, a lot of that stuff should be pretty findable online. So the Foreign Service Institute, that's where they train just for those listening that don't know, they train diplomats and people that will be basically working for the US government. I need to learn the language quick. I think if I recall, it basically uses the audiolingual method, just kind of a teaching method popularized in the 70s, I believe. Yes. I haven't used it myself, so I can't speak to it one way or the other, but it is something that a lot of people do recommend. So you were saying, so you found that helpful for Thai?
Yeah, I found it helpful. When I came across it, I was already quite far down my language learning route. But I still found it really helpful. Mm-hmm. But I did wish, I wish I'd had this from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Anything else coming to mind?
What else? Trying to think, some podcasts, Thai podcasts. I don't listen to them so much anymore. And just various books and also even available resources which are meant for children, but children's stories mm-hmm. that you can find in the local 7-Eleven shops and with CDs at the time. But mm-hmm. now you can probably just scan. And following those children's sounds, because the sounds are exaggerated, but mm-hmm. as a learner, you can generally follow along. That I found to be very useful, not only for the writing, but for the sounds, and to put those two together.
Yeah, because I guess that's part of the advice to nail the pronunciation early on and learn the sounds. I think part and parcel of that is learning the alphabet alongside that, right? Because it's not one or the other. But I do think one bit of advice is don't just start reading unless you also know how things are pronounced, because that's where you really develop mm-hmm. bad habits. It's when you fill in, I think it's pronounced this way. And then in your head, you're reading it a certain way hundreds or thousands of times till you fast forward 2, 3, 4 years later and someone says, that's not how that's pronounced. And you've already solidified definitely. That habit.
Yeah, start with the basic blocks and sounds. The way the kids do it, I think that's useful.
Mm-hmm. We talked about mistakes and kind of things you did on the professional side. Are there mistakes you think you made in learning Thai that you would try to avoid if you were to start from scratch?
There's definitely mistakes that I've made, but sometimes I think you have to make mistakes, but mm-hmm. it's probably about getting feedback and being aware of your mistakes. There's two parts to it. One, yes, making lots of mistakes, being comfortable making mistakes, mm-hmm. but also being aware of and how to improve those things at the same time. So having a system or having someone who can tell you the things that you need to work on.
Right.
So that you can make progress.
Which can be tough. You live in Thailand, and so you're surrounded by Thai. You're married to a Thai woman, right? So you have the opportunity to be corrected constantly. But I think most people are not going to actually correct you because they don't want to cause you to lose face. If they understand you and the point of your conversation is communication, they don't want to stop the conversation, especially in a relationship. Your focus is the relationship, not linguistics. Right? So it's not necessarily as easy, I think, as people assume to just live in a country or be dating or married to somebody from that language group. Correction, I think, is a skill, and it's a difficult one. And I think because of that, even if you live in the country where the language is spoken, I still think it's worth hiring a tutor or a teacher whose job is to call you out on your mistakes and to help you spot them and fix them. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. 100%. And working with children. Children are maybe more ready to correct you.
Right.
If you make mistakes.
Yeah, because they don't see it as a social faux pas. They will tell you what's what.
Yeah, which is what you need.
This is what you need. Yeah, yeah. And not in a disparaging way. You can have a laugh about it. Yeah. All right, David. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your journey with us. I'll put links in the show notes to your work. Yeah, any final words of encouragement for aspiring English teachers or aspiring Thai learners out there?
Just, keep going. Listen to this podcast, your podcast. And also, try to be aware that there's going to be a difficult time. It's not going to be a smooth journey, smooth line of improvement all the way up there. So when you do come across them and you're thinking, I'm going backwards or I'm not going forwards enough, to have that perspective and then to keep going. As we've mentioned, invest in a tutor, spend a bit of time looking around, find someone that you get on with well, that you enjoy spending time with, and keep going, because the rewards are so much greater than what you have to put in.
100%. Language ROI is very high.
Yes.
All right, David, thank you so much. Catch you in Thailand
Thanks
one
again.
Of these days.
Cheers, John. Appreciate
Cheers,
it.
David. Thank Hope you.
To see you.
Thank you for listening to the episode. Again, for show notes, go to languagemastery.com/show, and there you'll find a link to this episode show notes, which has links for all the resources and concepts mentioned in the show. And real quick, before you click away from this, think of one takeaway from today's episode that you can apply today, whether in your own language learning or if you're a teacher in your own language teaching. Listening to podcasts is all well and good, but acting upon what you learn in a podcast is all the better.